So this is the very first Sandra Day O'Connor conversation, and this is an inaugural event. This is part of a four-year series. I am really excited to be able to announce our second speaker. For next year, please mark your calendars for July 10th, 2018, when Evan Thomas, known to many of you as a biographer, who is working on a biography of Sandra Day O'Connor, will be our second Sandra Day O'Connor speaker. I want to extend greetings to the audience that is listening on Aspen NPR and also the overflow crowd in the Pepke Auditorium. We have a sold-out theater tonight, and also additional people both at home and over in Pepke. Justice O'Connor couldn't join us this evening for health reasons. She's represented this evening by her son, Brian O'Connor, and his wife, Sean, and we want to thank them very much for being here. Point of personal privilege. I've worked with Justice O'Connor since 2005 when I worked on a project called the Sandra Day O'Connor Project at Georgetown Law School. She has been, both on and off the court, a guardian of the institutional protections of democracy, notably federalism. In her jurisprudence, she took most seriously the power of the states to resist tyranny when it comes in the form of the federal government. That did not always make her popular. But as we now learned, it was profoundly wise. She has championed the independence of the judiciary. Many people took that as a given, but as we now see, she has been profoundly wise. And through her advocacy for civics education, to show young people that democracy is in their own hands and must be guarded through knowledge and education, she saw directly to our current predicament. As Justice O'Connor has said, as a citizen, you need to learn how to be part of it, how to express yourself, and not just by voting. Only a year ago, in our Justice and Society seminar classroom, there was a lively debate between a young feminist attorney who claimed that we were in the last inch of the struggle for gender equality and that women should turn to questions of intersectionality. An older woman rose to say that the gains of gender equality remain tender, and that what has been won also can be lost. What stands between us and tyranny very often is only the judiciary. Justice Kagan, like Justice O'Connor, has focused on guarding our freedoms, our autonomy, and the institutions of a free society. She brings to the Supreme Court the wisdom of a scholar, the tact of a law school dean, and the wit of the New York City girl that she was. Justice McGregor was Justice O'Connor's first Supreme Court law clerk. She practiced law for many years in Arizona at the Fenimore firm before she was appointed to the bench. She served on the Arizona Supreme Court as its Chief Justice. She continues to advocate for judicial independence and to teach. I'm delighted that she and her husband, Bob, both participated in the Justice and Society seminar a couple of years ago. And with that, let me welcome to the podium Justice Ruth McGregor.
Good evening, and thank you, Meryl. On July 7th, 1981, I was in my car driving to work at a Phoenix law firm where I was a relatively recent partner. Just a few days earlier, our lawyers and their spouses, including my partner John O'Connor and his wife Sandra, had returned from a firm outing to Prescott, Arizona, which has the oldest rodeo on the 4th of July. Of course, aware of the rumors that then Judge O'Connor was being considered for the Supreme Court, we asked her some questions. As you would expect, she was dismissive of the rumors and quickly turned any conversation to another topic. So as I drove that morning, I turned on the news just in time to hear President Reagan say, "She is truly a person for all seasons." I had missed the first part of his remarks, and I had not heard him say who she was. And during the rest of his remarks, he did not repeat the name. Only when I, of course, was pounding my steering wheel and asking, who is it? Who is it? Only when a reporter began speaking did I know that she was Sandra Day O'Connor. I reacted the way many women lawyers did, with great emotion. We hoped that the world for women in law had changed that day, and it had. Justice O'Connor's impact on women's opportunities began immediately. First, we immediately felt new energy and confidence that we could accomplish what we wanted. And also, she immediately disproved the notion that women could not handle the more demanding areas of legal practice. Because if a woman can handle being a Supreme Court justice, what areas should remain off limits to female women lawyers? And in addition, she was outspoken in educating those who would deny women opportunity. And she spoke not only to those in power, but those affected. Thousands of young women, many of us not so young anymore, tell moving stories of the difference she made when she spoke with them at their elementary or high school, at their law firm, at bar meetings, and at events that she organized at the United States Supreme Court. She also used her position and her influence to further other objectives important to her view of the essential nature of a judicial system that assures continued adherence to the rule of law. Explaining that judicial independence is the essential underpinning of our democratic government, she cautioned that such independence is tremendously hard to create and easier than most people imagine to damage or destroy. So working with organizations, local, national, and international, she spoke with leaders and judges and lawyers in numerous countries to help them reach their goal of forming an independent judiciary. Her work to further judicial independence and reliance on the rule of law led her to the realization that in this country, too few of our students and too few of our adults understand our government, our history, and our laws. Alarmed and frustrated by the lack of civic education available to middle and high school students, Justice O'Connor began a project, now known nationally as iCivics, to teach students about our government. The Aspen Institute Justice and Society Program has brought together all of these important strands of Justice O'Connor's legacy through the Sandra Day O'Connor Conversations, and I'm delighted to introduce the first of them. I begin by returning to the difference Justice O'Connor made for women in law, by noting that in 1981, this conversation would not have been possible. If we had looked in 1981 for a woman who had served as a state Supreme Court Chief Justice, our task would not have been impossible, but it would have been difficult since only four women had ever held that position. Fortunately, those things changed. Our interlocutor this evening, retired Massachusetts Chief Justice Margaret Marshall, spent 16 years in private practice and 4 years as general counsel to Harvard University before joining the Massachusetts Supreme Judicial Court in 1996 as only the second woman to serve on that court. She became its first female Chief Justice in 1999 and served in that capacity until 2010. Her commitment to equality and justice, honed as she worked to end minority rule in her home country of South Africa, became a hallmark of her service to the court. And in 1981, it would have been not just difficult, but impossible to hear from a woman who served not only as the first female dean of the Harvard Law School, but also as the first woman to serve as Solicitor General. We can do so today because we are joined by Justice Elena Kagan, the fourth woman to serve on the United States Supreme Court. Justice Kagan established a distinguished career in public service and academia before being confirmed as Solicitor General in 2009, and as you know, in 2010 as Associate Justice on the United States Supreme Court. She continues the practice, not initiated but much expanded by Justice O'Connor, of speaking publicly to explain the important role of the court and of the rule of law. These two women embody the traits Justice O'Connor has worked all her life to promote. They fiercely support judicial independence and the rule of law. They promote civic knowledge and engagement, and they serve as role models and mentors to young students. We are fortunate to have them with us. Please join me in welcoming Justice Elena Kagan and Chief Justice Margaret Marshall.
Justice Kagan, I have to say, just listening first to Merrill and then to Ruth McGregor talk about Justice O'Connor, it reminds me just how far we've come and in what shorter period of time in a way, and how thrilled I am to have you seated here, because and I think if we look forward, you have clearly been a glass ceiling breaker, a concrete ceiling breaker, whatever it was. I sometimes tell Justice Kagan that she's shorter than I am, because she was only knocking her head against concrete ceilings. Mine were only glass. Let me begin by simply saying, what's your view of Justice O'Connor anyway, anytime, any place?
Yeah. Well, thank you for asking me that question, because I have lots to say about Justice O'Connor.
Great.
All very laudatory. But first, let me thank the Aspen Institute for inviting me here, and to Merrill Chertoff in particular for inviting me here. And it really is my honor to be here to honor Justice O'Connor at this inaugural lecture named for her. Everybody knows that she is one of the most important Supreme Court justices. She was also one of the greatest Supreme Court justices. And judges can be great for different reasons in different ways. I think she was great because she did more good for this country than pretty much anybody in modern memory, at least, who has served on the Supreme Court. I mean, if you think about this, this is a little bit of a thought experiment, but suppose you were creating a constitution, and somebody said, here's an idea. We're going to take all the really hot-button, important issues in a society, and we're going to make sure that they all go to the Supreme Court. And then, the court's going to have 9 people in it, but really, for several decades, only one person is going to make all the decisions. And everybody will be talking to that person, they'll be writing briefs to that person, they'll be delivering their oral arguments to that person, because they all know that she's going to be the decision maker. Now, if you were in a constitutional convention and somebody said that to you, you would think that is ridiculous. You can't do that. You know, why that one person? Who was she or who was he? And the answer, though, is if it was Justice O'Connor, it would all turn out all right. And I can think of precious few people whom you can say that about. That in case after case, issue after issue, the most important issues of the day, the hottest issues of the day, the most divisive issues of the day, that because of circumstances, Justice O'Connor very, very often, almost always, cast the deciding vote, and she did so in a way that demonstrated extraordinary wisdom, that understood something about this nation, about the people who inhabit it, about what they would and would not stand for, about what their best values were. And she did this over and over and over again. And really, we are such a better nation because of that, because of her decisions and her votes. And there was a kind of practical wisdom that I think has almost never been seen on the Supreme Court that she had. And this nation had the very good fortune that for several decades, a person of that kind of practical wisdom actually made actually decided a lot of the most important Supreme Court cases. Now, I also, what's striking about Justice O'Connor as well is that after she retired, you know, most justices when they retire, they putter around a little bit.
Many justices retire.
Yeah, some of them no, but occasionally, you know, they putter around, they go make a few speeches. One of the most remarkable things about Justice O'Connor, I think, is that she had this whole second chapter after she retired. And the iCivics program that she helped to design and that she led for quite some number of years now has done remarkable things in terms of teaching students across the country about our system of government in ways that make it all seem like fun. And this curriculum that she's developed, I think, has been a great educational change. So she's had these two remarkable periods of achievement and accomplishment. Now, I have to say that maybe part of the reason for that is that Justice O'Connor is a woman who liked to get her way, So I'll just tell one personal story about that. And it goes back to when I was a very young lawyer. It was a couple of years after I graduated from law school, and I had the good fortune to clerk on the Supreme Court. And Justice O'Connor had been there for several years already. I clerked for Justice Marshall. And clerks get to know some of the justices a little bit, conversations around the building, an occasional lunch or two. I got to know Justice O'Connor in that way. And Justice O'Connor at the time, and I think throughout her tenure on the court, had an aerobics class, you know, like 1980s style aerobics. And one of the things that Justice O'Connor liked was that she thought that all the women clerks should come to her aerobics class. And there weren't too many of us then. I think there were only seven of us at the time. And she thought a good turnout would be seven. Now, at the time, I fancied myself kind of an athlete. And I thought, you know, aerobics, that was not like real exercise. That was not sport. And there's also, as some of you may know, a basketball court at the Supreme Court. And there are several times weekly, some of the clerks and other members of the court staff go up and play basketball. And I thought basketball was more my style. So I went and I played basketball. Now, the basketball court at the court, until a few years ago, was basically, the floor was basically concrete. And this meant that really you couldn't play on it for an entire year without seriously injuring yourself. And one day, it was my turn. And I tore some kind of ligament or tendon or something like that. And I was hobbling around. I was on crutches for several weeks. One day, I was at the court, and I was walking down the hall with my crutches, making my way very slowly. And Justice O'Connor was coming the other way. And she stopped, and she said, what happened? And I said, you know, I tore a tendon playing basketball. And she looked at me, and she shook her head very slowly, and she said, it wouldn't have happened in aerobics class. So that's my Justice O'Connor story. But I love Justice O'Connor, and so it's a real privilege to be here.
Thank you so much. Is that the end? Can we just keep...
You want me to say a few more words? Yeah.
Absolutely. But as you were telling that wonderful story, I thought Justice O'Connor liked to get away, but one of my guests here today likes to get away as well, and she was on the basketball court and not playing aerobics. But let me go back just to touch on the second part of her career, which both Meryl and Ruth have touched on. As you heard from Ruth, I come from South Africa, which didn't have an independent judiciary, and so I've really loved watching Justice O'Connor. And I want to read, if I can, just a short little piece that she said, in addition to the other wonderful quotes, and then I'm going to ask you how you got your own civic education. This is a quote from Justice O'Connor, which she's used many times. The better educated our citizens are, the better equipped they are will be to preserve the system of government we have. Knowledge about our government is not handed down through the gene pool. Every generation has to learn it, and we have some work to do. And I want to emphasize that when she's talking about our government, she's really talking about the structure, the function, I mean, these three branches of government, which do sometimes express themselves with nine justices and everybody deciding the hot button issues with one. Where did you learn your civics education? I mean, where did Elena Kagan come from? Because we haven't been teaching civics for a long time in our public schools or anywhere else. I know your mother was a teacher. Your two brothers are teachers. I don't know why you're not a teacher, but I think you are a teacher. Where did you sort of figure out how this fabulous system of government works?
Yeah, well, I was very lucky, and there are lots of kids out there that are nowhere near as lucky as I was. My parents were educated people. My parents were very involved in their community and in civic activities. And I went to great schools. And so when all those things happen, you know, it's easy to pick up things about how the government works. But not all kids are that lucky. And I think that you look at some of the polls that are done. Every year, it seems, another poll comes out and asking about what people know about the American system of government. Sometimes, you know, they'll read the First Amendment and they'll say, do you agree with that? And everybody says no. And, you know, they'll ask just, you know, about basic things about our structure of government, about the institutions, the presidency, Congress, the courts. It's always pretty shocking to me. I think what Justice O'Connor recognized was that schools had to do a much better job of this. And that's what she has done since she's retired from the court.
So let me just ask you a little bit more, push that. She has been mostly talking to high school students and elementary school students, but I am astounded at how many, frankly, lawyers don't really understand the difference between a constitutional democracy of the kind that you just described. Should law schools be doing more? Should universities be doing more?
Well, I hope that people coming out of law schools.
No, let me tell you, they don't. They don't all. Okay. I mean, last night we had a wonderful panel here, and Mickey Edwards, the former congressman, said, our colleges and universities don't teach a thing about civics and democracy. And he was emphasizing our colleges and universities. I'm just talking about the basic structure.
Right.
They may know about Marbury against Madison, you know, the great court that said you are the final deciders.
Yeah.
But it seems to me we still have an awful lot to do.
Well, I think if you haven't done this by the time you go to college, it's very possible that it will never happen. So I'm a big proponent of doing it early.
I know, we're not doing it in our public schools. I mean, it's wonderful that she has iCivics, but we just don't teach civics anymore. I mean, we just don't. Do your brothers teach civics?
Yeah, my brothers are both social studies teachers.
I know. Do they teach civics?
I think they probably do.
We're going to have them here next year and examine them to find out how much they... And I have some really dandy questions for them. And
okay, you will be amazed. I think you have a new job, Justice Marshall.
I do. And it's getting you back onto this panel to make my life look so much easier. So, Justice O'Connor, you heard Ruth talk about how she heard the news. I wonder how many people here know that Justice O'Connor's confirmation hearings before the Senate were the first to be televised in our nation's history. right? I mean, if you want to be a first, I mean, you heard how she is quiet and so on. First, where were you when you heard of her appointment?
Gosh, you know, I don't remember where I was at that moment, but I completely agree with Justice McGregor about how important Justice O'Connor was for lawyers of my generation, women lawyers, and also men lawyers of my generation, in terms of the path that she set. And when it came time for my confirmation hearing, you know, you get up in front of the cameras and you're allowed to speak for 5 minutes and to thank the people who ought to be thanked. And two of the people whom I thanked were Justice O'Connor and Justice Ginsburg, because that generation of women lawyers and Justice Marshall, you know, made all the difference in the world to people one generation on. Justice McGregor said of me that I was the first this and the first that, and I guess technically speaking that's true, but it was more a matter of fluke than anything else. There were women deans of premier law schools before me, and there was a woman attorney general before there was a woman solicitor general, and you know, women had already cracked that ceiling, not as much as you would wish, but it had already happened, and it happened because of people like Justice O'Connor and Justice Ginsburg, who graduated at this time. I mean, it's such remarkable stories. They graduated first in their class, and basically nobody wanted to hire them, and they had to make their careers up from scratch. They kind of had to figure out how to create these brilliant careers even when the institutions of the legal profession were saying, no, we're really not ready for women. And in doing that, those two women made such an incredible difference. For, you know, if you sort of think about the four Supreme Court justices, it's Justice O'Connor and Justice Ginsburg, and then 25 years on, it's me and Justice Sotomayor. And Justice Sotomayor and I would not have been possible except for Justice O'Connor and Justice Ginsburg.
Well, I'll accept that, but I will not accept that it was a fluke. I just wondered, it was no fluke. But let me ask you, you clerked for Justice Thurgood Marshall, the first African-American. Justice O'Connor was on the court, even if you didn't join her aerobics class. What did you learn about how they, in their role as justices, approached their work? What perspectives did they bring? I don't mean in a particular case, but how did you see that they went around their work?
Yeah, well, Justice O'Connor, I've always already spoken of about what I think makes her so important, and I can't really add anything in terms of what I saw on the court, because chambers do function a little bit as, you know, nine separate law offices, and so I wasn't privy to the conversations with her about how she decided cases and so forth. But it was one of the great honors of my life to have spent that year clerking for Justice Marshall and to have that opportunity to sit with him and talk about cases and to talk about anything else he wanted to talk about, and often he did.
Do you have any stories that you can share with us?
You know, the stories about Justice Marshall are so legion. The question is where to start. That he was, in my view, the greatest storyteller I've ever met. He was, you know, just a raconteur. And we would come in and we would talk about cases, and those were serious conversations. I guess the thing that I most really learned about Justice Marshall, the lawyer, was this, and I try to apply it every day, that he had the knack of seeing straight to the heart of what most mattered in a case. You know, a lot of our cases, they're very complicated, they're very complex. You can ask 1,000 zillion questions dealing with various facets of them. But often the thing you want to do when you decide a case, the thing maybe you want to do at argument in a case, is to really ask the single question that kind of goes to the heart of the matter, and once you know the answer to that, everything else falls into place. And I thought that Justice Marshall had that you know, I would call it a real lawyer, great lawyer's skill of seeing to the heart of something. But of course, I think that the reason that we all felt really privileged to clerk for Justice Marshall was not just because he was a Supreme Court justice and he had these great lawyerly skills that he brought to the bench, but because he had been this extraordinary lawyer. I mean, I think the greatest lawyer of the 20th century, bar none, in part because of his skills and in part because of what he used them to do. If being a great lawyer is doing a lot of justice, there's nobody who did more justice than Thurgood Marshall did in that period of time, and you know, maybe ever. And he talked a lot about his life and about his work for the Legal Defense Fund. And sitting there in his office and being regaled with these mm-hmm. stories, many of which were extremely sad, tragic, horrible stories, and somehow you were both crying and laughing at the same time because of the way he told them. But it was you know, I'll always look back in that to that year and think, boy, I had the opportunity to hear from this really quite extraordinary, great man in a way that very few people did about his life, about the way he viewed the law, about the way he viewed the world. So it was a real treat.
Well, I think he taught his law clerk one wonderful thing, which is how to be a raconteur. So I don't know whether you've picked up the rest of it, but you've certainly picked that up.
I don't hold a candle, I can assure you.
Let me just say a little bit more about being sort of first woman, first African-American. We've had those first, and they are important, but there was a 25-year gap before the third and the fourth were appointed. And there's an awful lot of discussion going along, and I'm looking at our students here, where there's evidence that you can be the first, and in some ways I was the first, and then other things came more easily, but it's the third and the fourth and the fifth and the sixth, and we seem to get stuck. So when you are talking to people who haven't been at the very top, who haven't been the Solicitor General, who haven't been the Dean of the Harvard Law School, what advice do you give them that can give them the same kind of inspiration that Justice Marshall and Justice O'Connor gave to you?
Well, I don't know that I have much advice about how to become Solicitor General or how to become...
Don. Yeah. We were hoping for that would be an inside tip. So.
Yeah, but I, you know, be in the right place at the right time is, I think,
sure.
what I would say. But I guess, yeah, when I was dean, whether I wanted to or not, I had to do a lot of advice giving to a lot of young lawyers. And mostly what I told them was to sort of follow their own passions, to use law school and to use the early years of a legal career to find out what really mattered to them and what made for genuine meaning and fulfillment in their lives. And it's different things for different people. And to try to sort of say, well, I'm just going down this channel because it's what all my friends are doing, is the worst mistake you can make. But instead to really use those years to find a job that when you wake up in the morning, you just can't wait to get to work because what you're doing has real meaning and what you're doing you think matters. Because I think, you know, it's in jobs that really matter that people find their own greatest personal fulfillment.
And did you know where you were headed, or did you sort of find your way there?
I didn't at all know where I was headed. My career path was lots of twists and turns and zigzags, and one moment I thought I was on a path to do one thing, and then it turned out I was on a path to do something completely different. I mean, if you had asked me 18 months before I became a Supreme Court justice, I was in my sixth year at Harvard Law School, and if you had said, well, what's the next thing? I would have said, the next thing, I'm going to spend a few more years here, and then I'm going to go be a university president someplace. And my view was I was going out of law entirely. And then all of a sudden, something happened, and I got this opportunity of a lifetime to become Solicitor General, which really did a little bit come out of the blue and you know, all of a sudden I was a person who would naturally be considered to be a justice, and that was wildly unexpected.
So before you became the Solicitor General, who is the lawyer for the United States before the United States Supreme Court, had you ever argued before the court?
Yeah, I hadn't, and I'll do you one better. I hadn't argued before any appellate court. Here's like a little bit of a story. I had been contacted by some people in the Obama White House, and they had asked me whether I was interested in a particular job, and I won't say what the job is. I'll just tell you that it was not Solicitor General. And I said, yes, I would be interested in that job. It was another very good job, but not Solicitor General. And it was a job where I thought, well, you know, this is a job that kind of makes sense, that I have some of the experiences and skills to do quite well in this job. And then I was pretty far along the way through the vetting process, you know, where everybody reads every word you've ever said and talks to everybody you've ever known since kindergarten. And I was pretty far along the way, along that process, and I suddenly got a call and it said, well, we've decided that not going to get that job. We want to know if you want to be Solicitor General. And I kind of said, what? And I really did say on the phone, I said, I've never done a statement. I'm not the person you want or need, or I'm not the right person to be that job, to fill that role. And they said, no, we're really, you know, we've sort of thought about this a lot, and we're really confident you can do this. And so I had to think about it a little bit.
Uh-oh.
And so I said, yeah, I'll call you back in a day or two. And I hung up the phone, and it really was a little bit of a, gosh, I just don't know if I am the right person for this. Yeah, you know, I have a healthy self-regard, believe me. But I just didn't know whether, you know, you just said it. You'd never done an argument in an appellate court.
I didn't realize it was no appellate court. Yeah. I was giving you a way out.
But then that self-regard took over again, and I called them back, and I said, yes. And so that's what I found myself doing. I couldn't have done it, except that the Solicitor General's office is such a remarkable place. Yeah. This is the office. Can anybody hear anything that I'm saying? This is the office that does all the appellate litigation for the United States. So in all the appellate courts, and particularly in the Supreme Court. And it's staffed with these fantastic appellate lawyers who stay the same from administration to administration to administration. There are only two people that the president appoints to the Solicitor General's office. All the rest are people who are there regardless of party or of administration. And they're remarkable lawyers, and they were incredibly generous people. And they basically, you know, taught me everything I know, whatever that is.
And do you remember your first argument? Did you start off with some of the intermediate appellate courts or just try it out over there, or did you just go straight for the big?
Yeah, well, I didn't actually have that opportunity. My first argument was a special session of the Supreme Court. They call it a special session just so I could do my first case, which was a re-argument of Citizens United.
Oh.
So you know, Citizens United sounds as though you know it, which is all about campaign finance regulation. And it had been thought of as a kind of small case when it had been argued by one of the deputy solicitors general. And then the court decided that actually it wanted to reconsider some of the precedents on which the case was based. And so an order came out saying, well, we want this re-argued in a special session of the court happening in September when the term really starts in October. And the lawyers are instructed to brief the following questions, those questions being whether to overturn very significant campaign finance decisions of the court. Now, you can imagine that this was a little bit petrifying.
Oh, not at all, not at all.
I very much felt, my gosh, this is my first argument, and it's such a big deal, it's such a big issue, and sort of the eyes of the world are on me, and I better not mess it up. The one thing that that I said to myself, and I think it was right, was, you know, in the end, probably your argument is not going to make the difference, is that when the court does something like that, yeah, there's a pretty good sense on the court's part that it knows what it wants to do, that it's, you know, giving everybody an opportunity to brief questions that they didn't have before, but that probably there were five justices who were ready to overturn these cases and to issue this decision. So I hope I didn't lose the case. You know, I don't think I did. But it was a pretty petrifying experience. I'll tell you one story from that
argument.
And so my heart is beating really hard. I mean, literally, it's the only time in my life where I have known what that expression means. I practically couldn't hear anything because of the pounding that was happening inside my own body. And I thought, how am I going to do this? And I got up to the podium and I had memorized, as people do, three or four or five sentences to start with. And at the end of the first sentence, which frankly I hadn't really thought was the key sentence, it was it sort of seemed to me a fairly undisputed anodyne kind of sentence. At the end of the first sentence, Justice Scalia leaned over the bench in this way that I grew to know that he has. I had just said something. I had made a short declarative sentence, and he said, "Wait, wait, wait, wait." Except he said it even more strongly than that. And then he proceeded to tell me why this single sentence was wrong. But it was the best, it was the absolute best thing that anybody could have done, because it just forced me to be in the game right away. And my own view is that he knew that.
Absolutely.
That he knew, you know, from the sound of my voice saying that single sentence, that I was a little bit shaky. And he was just going to put me into the game right away. And if somebody challenges you, you have to stand right back. And that's what happened. And it turned out fine. I told the story once before, maybe even a couple of times before. And I had remembered it in my head as Justice Scalia leaning forward on the bench and saying, "No, no, no, no." That was really the way I had remembered it. And then one of the reporters who saw that speech that I gave said, "You know, it wasn't four no's; it was four waits." So.
Well, I hope from that maybe you could learn from another great law teacher, which is when you say "wait," everybody hears "no." So that was, you said that there was an expectation that five justices were at least preliminarily prepared to overrule some of the leading precedents. We've just completed a year on the court. The court runs from October to June, where there were only eight justices. Can you talk a little bit about what that experience was like? Because the court did not stop issuing opinions. There were opinions that issued throughout the year. There were a couple that there was a sort of tea leaf reading that maybe they had been held. But, you know, the year went on and on and on and on. And it's not that easy to nominate and confirm another justice to the court. And so there seemed to be, I don't want to say more consensus, but I mean, you had to reach a decision with eight justices, a rather unusually long period of time. What, if anything, can you tell us about that? Not so much about the particular cases, but the sort of why that was a different time.
Right, right. Well, we went the better part of two terms with eight justices, because Justice Scalia passed away in the middle of two terms ago.
2016.
But before most of our cases had been decided, or issued. And then most of this year, this past year, also with eight until Justice Gorsuch got confirmed and sat in the last month of the term. So for the better part of two terms, we had to do exactly what you're saying, was, which is make decisions with eight people. And, you know, there is a reason why appellate courts do not have even numbers of members. And it's because when you have an even number of members, every case can end in a tie. And then you're not doing the job that you're supposed to be doing, which is actually deciding cases and deciding important cases and resolving divisions among lower appellate courts and so forth. But that said, I think that the two-year period had one silver lining. I mean, nobody would want to do it forever, but I think that there was something that we learned during that two-year period, which I'm hopeful will have a lasting effect. And that's this. I mean, as you say, we did keep issuing decisions. That was because all of us were committed to trying to issue decisions, that we didn't want to look as though we couldn't do our job. And I think that was right across the board, that people said, every 4-4 decision where we just throw up our hands and say we affirm the decision below, every 4-4 decision is a failure on the part of this court. And so we worked very, very hard mm-hmm. to reach consensus and to find ways to agree that might not have been very obvious. And you know, sometimes they'd led to a kind of silliness. Sometimes the thing we found to agree on was something that really nobody cared about. But often, I thought that the process was very good in terms of finding, you know, ways to massage issues, modify issues in such a way that all of a sudden we could see the prospect of a broader consensus than might have appeared on first glance. And, you know, I think that that was a good thing for us to learn. The Chief Justice has said from the very beginning of his tenure that he cares a lot about achieving as wide a consensus in our decision making as we can. And I think that even before these two terms, we do that much more often than people give us credit for. About half of our cases are decided unanimously. Another significant set are decided with only one or two dissenting votes. But still, I think we managed to find consensus in places during these last 2 years that we might not have expected to find, you know, out of necessity. And because of some really great leadership skills of the Chief Justice. And you know, I hope we remember that, and I hope we continue to sort of go the extra mile to see if we can find ways to build bridges across seeming differences and to develop more consensus than you think might exist.
Well, it's Justice Kagan, I'm going to, with great difficulty, have to turn my back on you because I'm going to ask the audience if there are questions, and maybe while we're coming up with questions, I'll just ask you one other quick question. It's a very serious question, but we've talked a lot about the independent judiciary, and I know that Justice O'Connor has become increasingly outspoken about threats that she sees to our constitutional democracy, primarily, I think, not because of attacks on particular criticisms of Supreme Court decisions, but the kind of conversation that seems to me to suggest that the Supreme Court, unlike the other two branches, is somehow beholden to the popular will, you know, the majority of people. Do you have any observations from sitting on the court? I mean, are you aware of the sort of increasing concerns?
Well, I think we tune a lot out because
you have to.
Because you have to, right? I think you know this. And I think it's really important not to say this in a way that suggests that the judiciary shouldn't be criticized.
Absolutely not.
Because the judiciary in our system of government is doing awfully important things. And any given decision, some people may support and other people may oppose, and both sides have a right to say their piece. And so I think it's quite important that talk about this not suggest that somehow we are immune from criticism and everything we do is perfect. But at the same time, I think certainly other actors in the system of government, federal, state, presidents and governors, members of legislators. They too can criticize, but you hope that they respect the judiciary's important role in the system. You said at the very beginning of our conversation, we're not a pure democracy, we're a constitutional democracy. And that means that the judiciary has an important role to play in policing the boundaries of all the other branches. And that can make the judiciary an unpopular set of people when they say to a governor or a president or a Congress, no, you can't do that because it's just not within your constitutional powers or because it infringes on an individual's right. Those decisions also can be criticized, but you hope and I think it's been one of the great glories of this American constitutional democracy is that the great, great, great majority of time, however unhappy other governmental actors were with the court and the court's decision, they understood that that was the court's role and they respected the court's judgments. And that's what you hope happens in the future as well.
And if I may just add a coda to that, the fact that the other branches of government and our people accept the decisions of the United States Supreme Court is a remarkable achievement of the past several hundred years. It wasn't always that way, and it probably always won't be that way. And there are many countries around the world who've tried to copy our model with their own adjustments, but where it is not so obvious that when the court rules, it will automatically be obeyed.
Yes.
So I think that is, from my point of view, one of the great treasures. Now,
here.
The first question I know is going to go to one of our young scholars, and then for other people, please put up your hands if you would like to ask Justice Kagan a question, because there are mics and somebody will find you. Yes.
As a justice of the Supreme Court, you are responsible for upholding a constitution that was written over 230 years ago. How do you honor your oath to uphold that very constitution while acknowledging societal change? And how might that responsibility come into conflict with your personal beliefs?
Well, that's a big, deep question.
She is, after all, one of five scholars selected from across the country to be here, so more power to you.
Can we go to one of the adults now?
Oh, let me tell you, I'm waiting. They're so shocked, nobody's putting their hand up.
So I think one of the most important things for any judge, whether it's a Supreme Court justice, whether it's a trial judge, anybody, is to understand that your personal beliefs are not what matters. The law matters. Now, I'm going to talk about, sometimes it's hard to figure out what exactly the law is demanding, but it's the law that matters. And your policy beliefs, your personal beliefs, you have to put those aside. You have to put them in a box. Because when you're interpreting a statute, it might not be the statute that you would have written. Too bad. When you're interpreting the Constitution, it might not be the Constitution you would have written. Too bad. It's the Constitution that we have, and your oath of office and your responsibility to the American people is to do your best to interpret and apply the law that we have, the statutes that Congress passes, the Constitution that was ratified, as you say, more than 200 years ago. Now, sometimes that is a hard job. Your personal beliefs can be in that box, and it's just a hard job on which people would disagree as to how the Constitution ought to be interpreted, what it means with respect to any given situation. And as you say, that job, part of the reason that job is hard is because of the passage of time that you're talking about. But part of the reason that job is hard is because the drafters of the Constitution actually knew that that passage of time would happen. They wanted this Constitution to stick around for a long time. And because they knew that, they wrote it not to be very specific. There are all these phrases in the Constitution which are not self-defining, which, you know, they don't tell you exactly what that means for any particular case. So if I say to you, and I'm going to use an example not from 1789, but from 1868, which is when the 14th Amendment was passed, which is the source of an enormous body of current constitutional law. If I say to you, well, the Constitution says that everyone's entitled to due process of law or to equal protection of the laws, now you have to tell me what that means. I mean, the dictionary just doesn't tell you that. And so you have to develop ways of deciding what it means to ensure that every citizen in our country has the equal protection of the law. Now, different justices have different views about how to do that, and I'm not going to use this to push my own view. Some justices say you really do have to look back and see whatever you can see about that moment when that amendment was ratified. I don't agree with that. I think that constitutional interpretation is more of an organic process. The way you understand and apply those provisions is by looking not only to what they meant at that moment in time, but throughout the stream of American history up through our own moment, and particularly looking at what the court has said about those provisions year after year after year after year. I think that that's what produces the decisions that are most faithful to the Constitution and that fit best in our current world. So that's how I do constitutional interpretation. Others do it differently. But we're all struggling with the same problem, which is every single one of us on the court, I have absolutely no doubt, are putting our personal views into that box as far as we possibly can. We do have different views about interpretation, about especially as to the Constitution, in some ways as to statutes as well. And those differences account for divisions on the court as to various important issues. But that's what all of us, every single one of us, is doing law rather than applying their own personal preferences in the way that they think makes best sense.
Any other questions? Yes.
Justice Kagan, I want to ask what advice you would have for young girls who have ambitions similar to your own, but face derailment along their path. For example, limited economics or lack of parental support or family obligations that seem insurmountable. How do you stick to your dream?
There are lots of girls and young women who are not nearly as lucky as I have been. And to stick to your dream when that's the case is they're doing something a whole lot harder than I've ever had to do. But, you know, I think success is mostly based on grit and determination for girls and young women who don't have great advantages. And the people who make it notwithstanding that and who and who succeed despite all the really terrible things that life has thrown at them, are the girls and the young women who just have a kind of stick-to-itiveness that nothing will ever beat them, I think. And there are some people like that who have come from backgrounds like that on the current court, and I'm unbelievably admiring of what they've accomplished. I'll just name names. The two people who are like that, who really just had just so much stuff thrown at them, are Justice Sotomayor and Justice Thomas. And their ability to rise above it all, you know, as I think both of them found people in their lives, but I think mostly it's because they have the kind of like steely determination and grit that says, you know, I am not going to let life defeat me. And it's an amazing thing to see.
What a great thing. Thank you so much, Sir Kagan.